Chapter 16. Along the yoke of the Eagle Ridge, far above the misty blue valleys that swept away east and west between the endless hills, and in the afternoon Charity came to him. With part of what was left of her savings, as he had hired a bicycle for a month, and every day after dinner, as soon as her guardian started to his office, she hurried to the library, got out her bicycle, and flew down the Creston Road. She knew that Mr. Royal, like everyone else in North Dormer, was perfectly aware of her acquisition. Possibly he, as well as the rest of the village, knew what use she made of it. She did not care. She felt him to be so powerless, that if he had questioned her, she would probably have told him the truth. But they had never spoken to each other since the night on the wharf at Nettleton. He had returned to North Dormer only on the third day after that encounter, arriving just as Charity and Verena were sitting down to supper. He had drawn up his chair, taken his napkin from the sideboard drawer, pulled it out of its ring, and seated himself as unconcernedly as if he had come in from his usual afternoon session at Carrick Fry's. And the long habit of the household made it seem almost natural that Charity should not so much as raise her eyes when he entered, as he had simply let him understand that her silence was not accidental by leaving the table while he was still eating, and going up without a word to shut herself into her room. After that he formed the habit of talking loudly and genially to Verena whenever Charity was in the room. But otherwise there was no apparent change in their relations. She did not think connectedly of these things while she sat waiting for Arnie, but they remained in her mind as a sullen background against which her short hours with him flamed out like forest fires. Nothing else mattered, neither the good nor the bad, or what might have seemed so, before she knew him. He had caught her up, and carried her away into a new world, from which, at stated hours, the ghost of her came back, to perform certain customary acts, but all so thinly and insubstantially, that she sometimes wondered that the people she went about among could see her. Behind the swarthy mountain the sun had gone down in waveless gold. From a pasture up the slope a tinkle of cowbells sounded. A puff of smoke hung over the farm in the valley, trailed on the pure air and was gone. For a few minutes, in the clear light, that is all shadow, fields and woods were outlined with an unreal precision. Then the twilight blotted them out, and the little house turned gray and spectral under its wizened apple branches. Charity's heart contracted. The first fall of night after a day of radiance often gave her a sense of hidden menace. It was like looking out over the world as it would be when love had gone from it. She wondered if someday she would sit in that same place and watch in vain for her lover. His bicycle bell sounded down the lane, and in a minute she was at the gate, and his eyes were laughing in hers. They walked back through the long grass, and pushed open the door behind the house. The room at first seemed quite dark, and they had to grope their way in hand. Through the window frame the sky looked light by contrast, and above the black mass of asters in the earthen jar one white star glimmered like a moth. There was such a lot to do at the last minute, Harney was explaining, and I had to drive down to Creston to meet someone who has come to stay with my cousin for the show. He had his arms about her, and his kisses were in her hair and on her lips. Under his touch things deep down in her struggled to the light, and sprang up like flowers in sunshine. She twisted her fingers into his, and they sat down side by side on the improvised couch. She hardly heard his excuses for being late. In his absence a thousand doubts tormented her, but as soon as he appeared she ceased to wonder where he had come from, what had delayed him, who had kept him from her. It seemed as if the places he had been in, and the people he had been with, must cease to exist when he left them, just as her own life was suspended in his absence. He continued, now, to talk to her volubly and gaily, deploring his lateness, grumbling at the demands on his time, and good-humoredly mimicking Miss Hatchard's benevolent agitation. He hurried off miles, to ask Mr. Royal, to speak at the town hall tomorrow. I didn't know till it was done. Charity was silent, and he added, "After all, perhaps it's just as well. No one else could have done it." Charity made no answer. She did not care what part her guardian played in the morrow's ceremonies. Like all the other figures peopling her meager world, he had grown non-existent to her. As he had even put off hating him. "Tomorrow I shall only see you from far off," Harney continued. "But in the evening there'll be the dance in the town hall. Do you want me to promise not to dance with any other girl?" Any other girl? Were there any others? As he had forgotten even that peril, so enclosed did he and she seem in their secret world. Her heart gave a frightened jerk. "Yes, promise." He laughed and took her in his arms. "Ugus, not even if they're hideous?" He pushed the hair from her forehead, bending her face back, as his way was, and leaning over, so that his head loomed black between her eyes, and the paleness of the sky, in which the white star floated. Side by side they sped back along the dark wood road to the village. A late moon was rising, full-orbed and fiery, turning the mountain ranges from fluid gray to a massive blackness, and making the upper sky so light that the stars looked as faint as their own reflections in water. At the edge of the wood, half a mile from North Dormer, Harney jumped from his bicycle, took Charity in his arms for a last kiss, and then waited while she went on alone. They were later than usual, and instead of taking the bicycle to the library, she propped it against the back of the woodshed and entered the kitchen of the Red House. Verena sat there alone. When Charity came in, she looked at her with mild, impenetrable eyes, and then took a plate and a glass of milk from the shelf and set them silently on the table. Charity nodded her thanks, and sitting down, fell hungrily upon her piece of pie and emptied the glass. Her face burned with her quick flight through the night, and her eyes were dazzled by the twinkle of the kitchen lamp. She felt like a night bird suddenly caught and caged. "He ain't come back since supper," Verena said. "He's down to the hall." Charity took no notice. Her soul was still winging through the forest. She washed her plate and tumbler, and then felt her way up the dark stairs. When she opened her door, a wonder arrested her. Before going out, as he had closed her shutters against the afternoon heat, but they had swung partly open, and a bar of moonlight, crossing the room, rested on her bed, and showed a dress of China silk laid out on it in virgin whiteness. Charity had spent more than she could afford on the dress, which was to surpass those of all the other girls, as he had wanted to let North Dormer see that she was worthy of Harney's admiration. Above the dress, folded on the pillow, was the white veil which the young women who took part in the exercises were to wear under a wreath of asters, and beside the veil a pair of slim white satin shoes that Ally had produced from an old trunk in which she stored mysterious treasures. Charity stood gazing at all the outspread whiteness. It recalled a vision that had come to her in the night after her first meeting with Harney. She no longer had such visions. Warmer splendors had displaced them. But it was stupid of Ally to have paraded all those white things on her bed, exactly as Hattie Target's wedding dress from Springfield had been spread out for the neighbors to see when she married Tom Fry. Charity took up the satin shoes and looked at them curiously. By day, no doubt, they would appear a little worn, but in the moonlight they seemed carved of ivory. She sat down on the floor to try them on, and they fitted her perfectly, though when she stood up she lurched a little on the high heels. She looked down at her feet, which the graceful mold of the slippers had marvelously arched and narrowed. As he had never seen such shoes before, even in the shop windows at Nettleton. Never, except, yes, once, as he had noticed a pair of the same shape on Annabel Balch. A blush of mortification swept over her. Ally sometimes sewed for Miss Balch, when that brilliant being descended on North Dormer, and no doubt she picked up presents of cast-off clothing. The treasures in the mysterious trunk all came from the people she worked for. There could be no doubt that the white slippers were Annabel Balch's. As she stood there, staring down moodily at her feet, she heard the triple click, click, click of a bicycle bell under her window. It was Arnie's secret signal as he passed on his way home. She stumbled to the window on her high heels, flung open the shutters and leaned out. He waved to her and sped by, his black shadow dancing merrily ahead of him down the empty moonlit road. And she leaned there watching him till he vanished under the Hatchard spruces. The town hall was crowded and exceedingly hot. As Charity marched into it third in the white muslin file headed by Orma Fry, she was conscious mainly of the brilliant effect of the wreathed columns framing the green carpeted stage toward which she was moving, and of the unfamiliar faces turning from the front rows to watch the advance of the procession. But it was all a bewildering blur of eyes and colors till she found herself standing at the back of the stage, her great bunch of asters and goldenrod held well in front of her, and answering the nervous glance of Lambert Salas, the organist from Mr. Miles' church, who had come up from Nettleton to play the harmonium and sat behind it, his conductor's eye running over the fluttered girls. A moment later Mr. Miles, pink and twinkling, emerged from the background, as if buoyed upon his broad white gown, and briskly dominated the bowed heads in the front rows. He prayed energetically and briefly and then retired, and a fierce nod from Lambert Salas warned the girls that they were to follow at once with home, sweet home. It was a joy to Charity to sing. It seemed as though, for the first time, her secret rapture might burst from her, and flash its defiance at the world. All the glow in her blood, the breath of the summer earth, the rustle of the forest, the fresh call of birds at sunrise, and the brooding midday languors, seemed to pass into her untrained voice, lifted and led by the sustaining chorus. And then suddenly the song was over, and after an uncertain pause, during which Miss Hatchard's pearl-gray gloves started a furtive signaling down the hall, Mr. Royal, emerging in turn, ascended the steps of the stage, and appeared behind the flower-wreathed desk. He passed close to Charity, and she noticed that his gravely set face wore the look of majesty that used to awe and fascinate her childhood. His frock coat had been carefully brushed and ironed, and the ends of his narrow black tie were so nearly even that the tying must have cost him a protracted struggle. His appearance struck her all the more, because it was the first time as he had looked him full in the face since the night at Nettleton, and nothing in his grave and impressive demeanor revealed a trace of the lamentable figure on the wharf. He stood a moment behind the desk, resting his fingertips against it, and bending slightly toward his audience. Then he straightened himself and began. At first she paid no heed to what he was saying. Only fragments of sentences, sonorous quotations, allusions to illustrious men, including the obligatory tribute to Honorius Hatchard, drifted past her inattentive ears. She was trying to discover Arnie among the notable people in the front row, but he was nowhere near Miss Hatchard, who, crowned by a pearl-gray hat that matched her gloves, sat just below the desk, supported by Mrs. Miles and an important-looking unknown lady. Charity was near one end of the stage, and from where she sat the other end of the first row of seats was cut off by the screen of foliage masking the harmonium. The effort to see Arnie around the corner of the screen, or through its interstices, made her unconscious of everything else. But the effort was unsuccessful, and gradually she found her attention arrested by her guardian's discourse. As he had never heard him speak in public before, but she was familiar with the rolling music of his voice when he read aloud, or held forth to the selectmen about the stove at Carrick Fry's. Today his inflections were richer and graver than as he had ever known them. He spoke slowly, with pauses that seemed to invite his hearers to silent participation in his thought, and Charity perceived a light of response in their faces. He was nearing the end of his address. Most of you. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.